This is former FCC Commissioner Mike Copps, and you're listening to WMRWLP in Warren, Vermont.
The following program presents the views of its participants and producers. It does not necessarily represent the views of WMRW or its license holder, RootsWork.
All right.
Good afternoon, Mad River Valley. This is Jerry Procaccini with the 4-H show, and the 4-H's are health, harmony, happiness, and humor. Hopefully we all have a little bit of all four of those, or a whole lot of all four of those, one or the other. I am hosting the show solo today, although we were supposed to be co-hosting. My co-host, Amy Hornblass, is unable to come in because of this weather. Doesn't get much worse than this, I don't think, and she's pretty far away. She's outside of Plainfield, so it would have been a little dicey for her to come in. And then we have a very special guest who I still plan on interviewing because he is going to call in. And his name is Dr. Sandy Ryder, and I'll tell you about him in a minute. First, I want to tell you that WMRW is generously underwritten by Darad Services, Inc., specializing in warrantied used Macintosh and PC computers since 1992. You can reach Darad Services by calling 802-496-2772. And I really want to thank our underwriters. We have a few. We can always use more, but they're vitally important to keep the station on the air. And so are our listeners who donate to the station. So if you like what you hear and you're a proponent of free speech and local radio, all volunteer, community-based, think about sending us in a donation. You can go online, wmrw.org, and make a donation there, or you can send us a check, whatever's easier for you. And if you appreciate our station and want to keep us on the air, please consider doing that. And I am going to tell you a little bit about my guest who will be calling in possibly right now. Hold on one second, and I will see if this is him. WMRW? Yes, it is. That's absolutely fine. Are you ready to go on the air? I can hear you fine, yeah. Sandy, are you there?
I'm here.
Okay. I would like to reintroduce my guest, who's calling in today due to the inclement weather. He's in Lindenville, and it's Dr. Sandy Ryder, and he is a medical practitioner, has a private practice in Lindenville, graduated from Harvard Medical School, and has a focus on nutrition, classical homeopathy, and anthroposophical treatments. Yeah. Anyway, Sandy, thank you so much for taking the time to call in.
Oh, you're welcome. I have a pretty loud echo on this end. I don't know if you can correct that.
Let me try. If I is that any better?
Yes.
Okay, good. Good. If it happens again, let me know.
Okay.
I thought maybe we'd start with just a little bit about your background and how you got interested in medicine.
Sure. Well, how I got interested was kind of following in the footsteps of my father, who was also a general practitioner and loved his work. And I didn't have any trouble deciding what I wanted to do when I was in college. So
wow, that's
I just
lucky.
And interestingly, in my medical school class, 87% of the fellow students, their fathers were doctors.
Is so, that right?
Yeah. Wow. Pretty crazy. So, yeah, I went, did that, and after medical school, I did my internship training at the Medical Center Hospital in Vermont in Burlington. And as soon as I got out of my internship, a number of my peers stayed on to do residency. Mm-hmm. It was also the time of the Vietnam draft.
Yeah.
And I applied quickly to the Public Health Service and was placed in Island Pond, Vermont, of all places.
With the military?
As a public health, yes. It was the first year of the National Health Service Corps. Yeah. Where they were putting physicians in places of need. And Island Pond was one such place. There were a couple of others. Lindenville was another year later. Gosh. Anyway, the Northeast Kingdom has always been a little short on medical help. So,
did you grow up in Vermont? Was your father a practitioner here?
No, I grew up outside of Philadelphia,
oh.
Pennsylvania.
Ah, something we have in common.
Yeah, right. Right.
So then you, where did you go from the military? Were you in the military 3 years? Is that the normal?
2 years.
2 years.
And in the, after my 2 year stint, that was 1972 to 1974. Mm-hmm. And from there, I went to full time emergency room work, really up in the Newport area. I was the first ER doctor in Newport. That was before hospitals had regular staff, and continued doing emergency room work for 12 or 13 years, I think.
What made you decide to stay in the Northeast Kingdom?
Oh, gosh, that was easy.
Yeah?
I did take a kind of sabbatical to the Burlington area for 5 or 6 years, but came back here. Because I had bought some land, and I've always loved the outdoors and the woods and gardening and whatever. So I just, it was a natural way for me to come back here. Also, my son was just growing up and in grade school, and I wanted to bring him to a good place where he could have an experience like most kids in the Northeast Kingdom did at that time.
Yeah, that's
beautiful.
Great. Yeah, it really is a special place.
Yeah, so that's how I got here, and I've never really left, although, I went back to the Burlington area for a number of years before I came back up here.
Mm-hmm.
And in the meantime, I got very interested in anthroposophical medicine, which was Rudolf Steiner's teachings about medicine. You know, he was the one that conceived biodynamic agriculture and Waldorf schools, and he was active in a number of other areas. So, and through that also got interested in homeopathy through people that were studying, I was studying with at the time. And, once I got involved with that and met some of the people that were teaching it, I never really looked back. So it's become a very useful modality. You know, I still practice conventional medicine, but prescribe many, many fewer pharmaceutical drugs than I used to because of these other tools, I guess, in my toolbox.
Can you explain the difference between homeopathy and conventional medicine, like just a little bit for us novices?
Sure. I think in a nutshell, actually, the American Medical Association was formed in response to the strong homeopathic movement in the United States back around the turn of the century, the 1900 or so. Hmm. So that's how the American Medical Association came into being, because it was widely practiced, not just in Europe, but also increasingly in the United States. And the Rockefeller Foundation more or less killed it with the Flexner Report back around 1920, where they insisted on the pharmaceutical model of treatment, which has its benefits as well, we all know. But the difference, as I see it now, and I, you know, I've been doing this, what now, for 52 years, the difference now is that most of the pharmaceutical medications that are released to the public and are widely used are used not to heal but to control symptoms, often suppressing them at the expense of recovery, in my opinion. For instance, like some years ago, there was a kind of a panic about a Tylenol shortage.
Yeah.
And that is probably one of the best things that could have happened. We now know that there are studies out recognized by the CDC and the conventional literature saying that the use of Tylenol during pregnancy increases the risk of autism. And Tylenol, like aspirin and so many anti-inflammatories, suppresses the immune system. It will bring down fever, which is critical for recovering from acute infectious processes. And I learned, well, after I got out of my internship, what they call residency now, after I got out of that, I spent over a week in the medical library in Burlington, this is before computers, researching vaccines, because I had a number of questions, and I was startled by what I found. And
which vaccines were you?
All vaccines at that time, and this was, my son was born in 1981, so I had a real motivation to try and understand the vaccination thing, which is probably the most important medical decision that parents can make for their children, you know, barring something like an auto accident or something out of the blue.
Yeah.
It's a critical decision. Back then, in 1981, there were relatively few vaccines for kids. There was the DPT, the diphtheria, tetanus, pertussis vaccine. They had stopped vaccinating for smallpox. And what else do they have? They had started up with the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine.
And polio, right?
Because
that's the only one I had when I was born in 54. So.
Right. When I was born in 45 and growing up, the only vaccines we have were smallpox, which I got, and the DPT. And later on in the 50s, the polio vaccine.
Yeah.
That was it. But so it was early days in the whole vaccine thing. Since 1986, when the vaccine drug makers were granted complete liability for any injuries, at that point, the vaccine schedule exploded.
You mean they were exempt from liability, right?
If your child was killed or permanently injured or whatever by a vaccine, you couldn't sue the drug company. Mm-hmm. And that remains in place today. So there is a system to compensate injured people, but it's really a tough one to navigate, as parents can tell you who have tried, and some have succeeded. I think the vaccine injury compensation program has now awarded $4 billion worth of damages for what they continue to claim are safe and effective vaccines. Mm. Although the Supreme Court, in a decision around 2011, declared vaccines unavoidably unsafe. So there's a lot of confusion around that.
And what that was, a court case? And
I think that was the court case of a case called Brucevitz versus Wyeth, and I forget the details, but that was at that point the decision was made that even if a vaccine company could have made a safer vaccine, they couldn't be held liable for it. And so it kind of took the wind out of the sails of the companies to try and develop safer and safer vaccines because they didn't have to. And I think we're seeing the fallout of that now, and certainly with COVID we're seeing that. So,
can you talk a little bit about Physicians for Informed Consent? That's an organization you, I believe, helped found or you're a member of?
Well, yes. That's basically a California-based group. After the exemptions were taken away from parents who were trying to decide what was best for their kids, the California legislature passed a bill removing philosophical and later religious exemptions for parents, which was their only way to their only line of defense against pharma, basically. Medical exemptions became almost impossible to get, really quite impossible to
get. Is that still in place in California?
Yes.
You still cannot get a religious exemption?
No, California, there's a couple of states that don't provide religious exemption. California is one, Mississippi is one. Maine, more recently, took their religious exemption away. And West Virginia, did I say that already? West Virginia doesn't allow one. Most states do, but there's been a concerted, there's been a real effort in Vermont for quite a while since they took away our philosophical exemption in 2015. There's also been attempts to remove the religious exemption, which would again leave parents with no protection whatsoever, because medical, I could talk about how hard it is to get medical exemptions, but they're very hard to get. Fortunately, there's no bill this year in the legislature trying to remove the religious exemption. I think it's partly due to the fact that one of the legislator, George Till from, where was he from? Somewhere in Chittenden County, has retired. So kind of that has gone away, but I expect it'll come back at some point.
I wonder, too, if it's possibly because people for the last 3 years have become so much more aware of what's going on. You know, I can speak for myself there. I think that may help, just awareness and education.
Yeah, it's interesting that this awareness of the meme of safe and effective, which has completely crumbled. If anyone bothers to look at the data from the CDC or from around the world, from Germany, from the UK, that the COVID vaccine itself is causing huge amounts of side effects. And we know now that it doesn't prevent infection or transmission, and its efficacy, if it has some, wanes quickly and soon turns into a negative efficacy, which means you're more likely to get the COVID. People have woken up to that, and some of the mainstream media is reporting on it now too, which is really a shift from the past where they wouldn't. People are waking up. I think the Rasmussen poll, which polled people on their attitudes, 25% of people knew somebody that they thought had died from the COVID vaccine, and 49% of people suspected that COVID vaccine was related to all the excess deaths that have been reported. And they've been widely reported. I don't know if I want to go into that right now, but excess deaths are from around the world are being reported that are non-COVID deaths, whether it's from myocarditis or blood clots, strokes, heart attacks, sudden deaths, congestive heart failure. All those things are way, way up since the vaccine rolled out.
You know,
and people are dying.
Yeah. I want to ask you about something. I got an email this morning. It's from United Healthcare, Medicare, and it says, it's not too late to help fight the flu. And then it says, get your no-cost flu shot this season. It's a powerful way to help prevent serious illness. And not only does it protect you, it helps stop the spread to others who may be more vulnerable or to serious illness or can't get a flu shot because of an allergy. And that's been an ongoing mantra for the last 3 years about the COVID vaccine. Even if you don't want to get one or you don't think you need one, you should get one to protect other people. And I'd just like to get your opinion of this.
Well, it's an easy answer for COVID because we know for a fact, the CDC has said this, Walensky, who is head of the CDC, has said it, that people who have been vaccinated against COVID are still able to be infected and transmit the virus to other people. And in fact, they're probably perpetuating what's going on, because by giving a vaccine that doesn't really eradicate the virus and allows it to continue to propagate, even if it's preventing some serious illness early on, allows the virus to adapt and develop certain resistance. And that's very similar to what most people are familiar with in terms of the overuse of antibiotics and the development of bacterial resistance, which has been a problem for many, many years now. Same thing is happening with the vaccine for COVID. It's driving the emergence of these new variants, which is kind of the same thing as resistance.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I think the vaccine is actually making the situation worse, and it makes the policies of, for instance, my son and his wife. My son lives in Switzerland, and his wife is a Swiss citizen and has not been vaccinated. She's not allowed to fly into the United States. But in my opinion, the vaccinated people are now more behind the emergence of new variants and the development of resistance to the vaccine.
Yeah, there seems to be...
That answers your question, but...
It kind of did, but I'm wondering, would you say the same about the flu vaccine? This email was specifically talking about the flu vaccine, which I've never gotten, and now I'm starting to think, gee, am I a detriment to my community because I don't get the flu vaccine?
Yeah, well, there's a couple of parts to that question. In terms of the flu vaccine, the Cochrane Collaborative, which is really, in the English-speaking world, the most trusted source of information for clinical interventions for clinicians and scientists to some extent, but really for people that are in the field like myself, because they're mostly independent from drug companies, which is a big one in terms of objective reporting. Their conclusion, this fellow named Thomas Jefferson in England, actually his name is Thomas Jefferson, was that the flu shot studies are so flawed and biased that it was impossible to actually have any conclusion about the flu shot's efficacy. And if you really look at the data about flu shots, you know, the way they calculate deaths from flu, it's really influenza-like illness deaths, usually involving bacterial pneumonia, that are counted as flu deaths. So that when you hear that 60,000 people died from the flu, that's not really true. When you look at laboratory confirmed cases, it generally is around 6,000, maybe 10,000 cases. It's much smaller. So the hype about the flu preventing flu is, I think, way overblown. And every fall we see this campaign to get your shot, to make people afraid of the flu. But it's really a marketing attempt to manufacture consent more than anything else.
Yeah.
And the idea that it prevents more serious illness, which is what they're saying now about the COVID vaccine, which is not true, not really based on much data. It certainly doesn't help people who are elderly to prevent death or hospitalization. That's been studied. For younger people, and particularly for young kids, it makes very little sense. And along those lines, I've been, like, had this thought for quite a long time that to the pharma drug companies, every infectious disease looks like a reason for a vaccine. So there are hundreds of vaccines in the pipeline and have been for years for almost any infectious disease you can imagine, some of which are serious, some of which are not. And among the ones that are not anymore are like diphtheria, which is in the DPT vaccine, or mumps, which is really not a serious disease.
Yeah, I had it when I was a kid and got better.
Yeah, almost everybody has
had it.
And once you get it, like, same with measles, same with chickenpox, you have lifelong immunity.
Yeah.
It's so superior to anything that a vaccine can produce. The MMR vaccine, which is always rolled out whenever there's a scare about measles. Now there's a scare about mumps, and the CDC has just said, if a mumps outbreak occurs, everyone needs to get another MMR vaccine. So I don't know if I really want to say this because people are going to criticize me, but there are advantages to getting these childhood diseases. The ones that are, I'm not talking about Ebola here. I'm not talking about the Black Plague. I'm talking about measles, mumps, rubella. Early on when I was in the library researching this, I realized that at that time, German measles, which can in a small percentage of cases, if a pregnant mother contracts, it can result in fetal malformations and deformities. So it was a problem. But what they were doing in England, which made complete sense, I don't think they're doing this anymore, particularly since Andy Wakefield days, was if a adolescent girl who was might become pregnant had not already developed German measles, then she could choose to be vaccinated, which made complete sense because then you weren't vaccinating everyone against it. Most children got it. I got it when I was a kid. A lot of kids do. Mm-hmm. And develop lifelong immunity. And so the vaccine isn't necessary. That was one part of the question. What else did you ask, Terry?
Well, I think that was the main part, but I want to, like, this informed consent. I was reading about on the National Institute of Health website. It talks about informed consent and how physicians and surgeons actually have a responsibility to make their patients aware of any risks versus benefits of any medical procedure. And I'm so baffled as to how we got to the point we are today when that, did we just blow that off? I mean, what happened to informed consent and the responsibility of physicians to talk about the risks versus benefits?
Well, yeah, that's, I don't know if I want to go into what's happened to me in this state around that particular issue. Maybe I will as a kind of,
yeah,
just to let people know what's happening in Vermont. And you, there's been a big push by this organization called the Federation of State Medical Boards, which is not even a governmental political organization. It's a organization whose head, oddly enough, is a physician in New Zealand, and its role is to basically to discipline physicians. And so there was, since the COVID started, a coordinated attack on any physician who spread disinformation, what they consider different disinformation. Of course, they would never specify what disinformation was, just disinformation. And this was happening around the country in multiple states at the same time. It was very well coordinated. And in, I would say, last fall, last October, a person who I don't know, who none of my patients know, who I'd never seen, acute sent a complaint to the medical board accusing me of spreading disinformation. And the only thing I had done, really, in this COVID era, I've been very quiet, honestly, was I wrote a commentary also in October. I guess the complaint was in November. In October, saying that the benefit, the harms for vaccinating children for COVID outweighed the benefits, likewise for pregnant women. And the paper, I think, got a fair amount of circulation, but apparently reached this person who's lives in another part of the state, and she complained. And the medical board's response, since you asked about informed consent, let me see if I can find it here. I'll bring it up on my computer.
I think I read your article before this morning, and the statistics that you posted are, how could they consider that misinformation? I mean, it was basically death rates of children.
Well,
and there are
what
no.
they did was, in the investigator's report, they sent me that no action was being taken because they really couldn't pin anything on me. You're right. That article, I didn't attack anybody, right? I just kind of tried to say what I thought was true.
Yeah, and I think you said children 0 to some 17 or possibly 12, the risk of death from COVID was 99.999%. I mean, it was like nothing. Just
right,
no
it's
risk.
Remained the same.
Yeah.
Actually, the evidence for vaccinating kids or not vaccinating kids has only been echoed by many other people, many other much more expert physicians than myself. And the harms are now being reported to VAERS for children 6 months and up in the 5 to 11 age group and the 12 to 18 age group. There's many adverse effects. I have all this data. I don't have the numbers on the tip of my tongue.
But you know, the statistics that I read in that article that you wrote, you didn't make them up. I mean, they're on the CDC website. The CDC
was over a year ago.
Yeah.
And I'm saying that it's only, there's not one thing in that article that I would change, except that it could be updated to strengthen the conclusions that I had.
But how do they determine that as misinformation? That's where I'm confused.
Well, so let me just finish this point I was making about the Federation of State Medical Boards and the response that I got from my medical board here. And the response was, hold on a second, that talking about physicians who spread COVID misinformation, I'm quoting from the letter now, and I'm waiving my right to privacy, obviously. Are risking disciplinary action by the state medical boards, including suspension or revocation of their medical license. Due to their specialized knowledge and training, licensed physicians possess a high degree of public trust, not anymore, by the way, and therefore have a powerful platform, whether they recognize it. They also have an ethical and professional responsibility to practice medicine in the best interest of their patients, and must share information that is factual, scientifically grounded, and, this is the key phrase, consensus-driven for the betterment of public health. By that, they mean the consensus, according to them, is that everyone should be vaccinated for COVID. That's exactly what they're trying to say. Spreading inaccurate COVID vaccine information contradicts that responsibility and threatens to further erode public trust in medical profession and puts all patients at risk. So by saying that, and you know, who knows how many other physicians have received letters like this in Vermont? Because this is confidential, nobody shares this. But I'm willing to step out and share it. And if anyone else in the healthcare profession or out there have had similar letters, I think we should get together. And because it's not right. They've actually passed a law in California to enforce this. And it gets worse when you go to British Columbia, things they've proposed to even put people in jail who've spread disinformation without specifying what that is. But what I was trying to get at was this particular mandate by the state, they said that I have free speech in my public pronouncements, like what I can say today, they can't really accuse me as misinformation. But in my office, talking to a private patient, I don't have that right, which is, of course, ridiculous and pathetic, in my opinion. It's not even legal. Misinformation is not illegal, really. So, you know, people just do their best. So that's the state of it. So by the medical board's own statements, I can't provide what I consider informed consent to patients in my office. That's mm-hmm. that's what it boils down to.
Yeah.
And why they're trying to throw informed consent under the bus when it is the bedrock of ethical medicine that's recognized globally. It has been, well, since after World War II in 1947 and Helsinki Agreement, the Geneva Accord, UNESCO, even the AMA Code of Ethics have all supported informed consent. So there's some backpedaling now with COVID. And
are you seeing that?
Am I seeing that?
Backpedaling, they're starting to...
Oh, yeah. Well, this letter is the clearest example that I can give you of the position of the health department on this. They're trying to make physicians enforcers of state policy rather than looking out for the best interest of their patient.
Oh, I'm sorry. I misunderstood you. When you said backpedaling, I thought you meant they're starting to come around. They're starting to back off.
No,
of,
I don't think so.
I see. You know, I haven't seen it either. That's why I was curious. But you mean, yeah. Stepping it up, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
What do you see as the biggest problem going forward with healthcare? I mean, what do we do?
Well, that's a great question. And in that vein, Health Choice Vermont has been on the front lines of this really since they tried to remove the philosophical or conscientious exemption in 2012, 2013, and failed at that time. But they were able to do that in 2015. So,
you know,
in that regard, Health Choice Vermont has sponsored bills in the legislature to protect, really protect patients' rights, public health at the same time, and individual freedoms. And this year there's a packet of bills. I'm trying to bring this up, sorry.
No worries.
Maybe you've seen them, Jerry.
I have, yeah, and they're on the Health Choice Vermont website. And
yeah.
While you're looking for them, maybe I will just say that last week I interviewed Jennifer Stella, who's one of the founders of, the founder or one of the founders of Health Choice Vermont. And on Thursdays, I always post my interviews on Front Porch Forum because that's how I get people to know who I'm interviewing and that's how I get them to listen. And I posted my interview with Jennifer, and Front Porch Forum didn't publish it. So I emailed them and they emailed me back and said, Front Porch Forum is working to verify the accuracy and safety of information being published. Children's Health Defense New England and Health Choice Vermont have both been associated with misinformation about public health. Therefore, publicizing an interview with a leader of these groups is against our policy. And you can look up our policy and there it is. And I was so floored by that because they're suppressing our constitutional right to free speech. I mean, Front Porch Forum, at least in the Mad River Valley, has replaced our local paper as the place where people go to find out what's going on. So if they decide they're going to eliminate something like this, they're really cutting you off from people knowing that you're doing the interview. And it's
here in Vermont. It's alive. Censorship is alive and well. And so there's a number of bills, I think four, maybe five bills that are in the legislature now. And they all are, as I said, trying to protect parental choice on behalf of their kids, to protect adults, to guarantee informed consent and bodily autonomy, and also to prevent, this bill is not quite out of, hasn't got a number yet, to prevent discrimination on the basis of vaccine status. That means travel, going to the gym, going to a movie, going to the legislature, going to a restaurant, all
going
these
to work.
Things where people interact with society. That needs to be protected. And as you know, it's been a kind of difficult in this COVID area where people are really seem to be afraid of people who aren't vaccinated, which is ironic because it's kind of the other way around in
at
a way.
This point.
So anyway, so there are all these bills, and if anyone wants to read them, I think it's the other bill that I didn't mention, sorry,
okay.
is a bill to require our health department to publish, to gather and publish data from reports to VAERS involving Vermont citizens. And would require reporting to the legislature and to the legislature and the Department of Health to inform all health care providers about the data, just so people have that information. It's been difficult because before COVID, honestly, hardly anyone even knew what VAERS was, even though it's a federal law to report injuries.
I didn't.
But almost no one knew it. I talked to a physician in Ohio. She had interviewed 200 medical emergency room docs. Not one of them knew a thing about VAERS.
The emergency
Amazing.
Room doctors?
Yeah, they didn't know. And most doctors didn't know either, even in Vermont. They just don't know. They don't pay any attention.
Wow, that's surprising. I mean, I felt bad that I didn't know until COVID, but it's amazing.
You're not alone.
That medical professionals don't know. I mean, so they never, when they have an adverse event, they don't even know that that is there, that they can report it?
Well, no, that's true. They're not familiar with the reporting system, but they also have seen many adverse effects, and it can't be from the vaccine. It's just a coincidence. Can't be from the vaccine. So whatever reactions they're seeing, they kind of on a certain level won't blame it on the vaccine or recognize it as a vaccine reaction. So that's part of the problem as well. I think with COVID, that's changing somewhat.
Mm-hmm.
I like to think that I'm not the only one, the only physician in the state who understands this problem. And I would certainly love to see other people come out of the closet and and join in.
Well,
it's a problem.
Your organization, Physicians for Informed Consent, or I guess you're a member of or a co-founder of, are there any other physicians in Vermont who belong to that?
Not that I know of.
Oh, geez.
But that doesn't mean there aren't any. I just don't know of any.
Yeah.
And I don't think, I actually probably don't think there are, or else I'd know about them. But when I say I'm a founding member, I was recruited by this fledgling organization, talked to the director, and this was, again, after they'd taken all the exemptions away from parents. And I happily jumped on board. I mean, it was like a no-brainer for me. I grew up talking about informed consent over our dinner table. It wasn't such a leap for me. And the thought of practicing medicine without that firm commitment, ethical commitment to informed consent would be impossible. really. Yeah. Any patient who comes into an office wants your honest opinion. They don't want some state-mandated directive. So.
Yeah, and it seems like it's almost attached to the Hippocratic Oath. I mean, do no harm. Wouldn't you look at it that way? So how do physicians not see that?
Well, it's actually, informed consent is different from the Hippocratic Oath. The Hippocratic Oath is a, well, it's actually, it's somewhat similar. Informed consent was the first articulation globally ever to protect patients. This is a patient protection bill. It was not to protect physicians. It was a patient protection bill, and I don't think many people understand that. Otherwise, they wouldn't. They'd pay more attention to it. You know, take some freedoms, like freedom of speech, bodily autonomy, informed consent, when they see a doctor, so much for granted, they don't feel like they need to even think about it. But once it's gone, people will wake up. I hope it doesn't come to that, but it's sort of coming to that in this COVID era, for sure.
I just need to say, because we're hitting the 1 o'clock mark, that you are listening to WMRW LP Warren 94.5, streaming at WMRW.org. And I am interviewing Dr. Sandy Ryder. He is a medical physician practicing in Lindenville. He's had his own practice for the last 30 years. He's also a graduate of Harvard Medical School. And this program presents the views of its participants and producers, does not necessarily represent the views of WMRW or its license holder RootsWork. And I know we're going a little over, so are you okay with staying for a few more minutes?
Oh, yeah, I've got plenty of time.
Okay, good. You know what you were just saying about informed consent and do no harm, and it seems to me like it's for protection of both the physicians and the patients, because it protects the physicians. Wouldn't you as a physician want to give as much information as you can to your patient, so that sort of protects you when they make the decision that yes, they want to go ahead with a medical procedure?
Yes, and it's very clearly articulated, particularly for hospital patients in Vermont. If you read their policies, they have very strong protections, like you don't operate on someone without their consent. You don't really do much without a signed consent. But in outpatient practice, and certainly in public health, as we've found out, it doesn't seem to apply very well.
Yeah. Well, you know, there is where the glitch is. It seems like the government has an out because they made it emergency use authorization rather than approved by the FDA. Am I correct in assuming that? It gives them actually more ability to make these mandates than if it was approved. Is that correct?
Yes and no. I mean, with the EUA, emergency use, which is kicks in what they call the PREP Act, which gives an extra layer of liability protection for any of the countermeasures that they would propose. And those include sending healthy people home en masse and closing businesses, which has been a serious infringement on our rights. It includes social distancing, for which there is zero scientific proof. It includes putting masks on people, particularly little children, where the science, there's no good science supporting masking of anyone, particularly kids. And we could go into that a little bit, but all those countermeasures, which cause some of them great harm, whether it's death from despair, from being isolated, loss of educational opportunity, loss of socializing, particularly for kids and teenagers, it's been such a shame, isolating. All those harms are covered by the PREP Act, so you can't really sue on the basis of that. There was even a child in southern Vermont some time ago whose parents requested the school not to vaccinate them against COVID, and They did anyway, which is like not only opposite of, it was kind of the opposite of informed consent. They had already refused it for their child, and the child got vaccinated anyway. And they were covered by the PrEP Act, so no action could be taken.
Well, didn't they file a lawsuit and they lost?
Yes.
Is that the case?
They did.
Yeah,
they
I just read about that. It's like unbelievable.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really shows you where we are. So.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, to me, one of the biggest problems connected to this is the censorship, because people aren't aware of what's going on, because any information that may show them what's going on is censored. They don't hear it. Unless you really do the research and go out of your way to find it, you're not going to hear it on the 6 o'clock news.
Yeah, free speech is kind of the prerequisite for so many of other rights. So censorship is one of the first tools any authoritarian government employs to control society.
Yeah.
It's to it. It's necessary.
A couple of, a year ago, I wouldn't even have seen as much correlation between what's happening right now here in the United States and what happened in Germany and what happened in Russia. I mean, that's how you get authoritarianism, when you suppress free speech.
Yeah, there's so many examples of that. You know, Germany for sure is one, Mussolini in Italy, Franco in Spain. Who else currently? Apparently the United States now. Israel was, it's ironic, you know, in World War II and all the stuff that happened to the Jews in World War II. It's so ironic that Pfizer made a contract with them to vaccinate as many people as they could, even though we know it's entirely experimental. To vaccinate everybody and provide them with the data. And Israel has pretty good data as a result of this, but it's ironic that the Jewish people were chosen to be the experimental subjects. So
and the
I've
data,
been warned to stay away from this whole topic of, I won't say the word because it triggers so many people, but there are parallels to many other authoritarian regimes, they came into being.
You were mentioning countries. How about Canada? Justin Trudeau and what they did.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
It didn't get much more
Canada,
authoritarian.
Australia,
than that.
New Zealand, Austria, Germany. I will say, Austria. I don't think this is out of bounds, that Vera Sharov, who's an 80 octogenarian woman who lives in the States now, survived a concentration camp. And on the anniversary of the Nuremberg trials, where a lot of these policies were developed, she spoke in Germany. And as a result of her speech, she is now a wanted person in Germany.
Is that right?
Of all places.
I didn't know that.
That authoritarian tendency is alive and well in many places right now. It didn't really go away. And I think, you know, it's obvious what we're seeing with this coordination across the world between media, big tech surveillance, public health agencies like the WHO being coordinated, all happening in lockstep at the same time. It's very clear that there's a larger agenda in play. I'm not really keen on talking about that, but it seems to me that it couldn't be otherwise, really.
Yeah. I know I kind of did want to stick to the medicine part of it with you, but it is uncanny. And I just watched Vera Sharov just made a documentary called Never Again Is Now, and it's the correlation. And she is the most legitimate person to be able to do something like that because she was part of it. So,
she's very well spoken. It's a pretty long 5-hour film.
It's long, but even if you watch just the part five, it's pretty eye-opening. And then back to Canada, you know, and again, we're kind of getting off topic of medicine, but we're not, is when the truckers were having that protest and they cut off their finances. And if we get this digital currency, I mean, you one click and you can be cut off from buying groceries from, you know, and that's kind of what they did to the truckers who were protesting. So you're not allowed to protest anymore. It's, you know, it is scary.
Well, it's interesting. I just read yesterday, yes, there's, it is a little tricky to get into the larger agenda here, but I just read yesterday that in Brazil now, where they have instituted what they call universal basic income, which is a digital deposit in your bank account, unless you are vaccinated, you cannot get it.
Is that right?
Yes. So that was kind of shocked me because it's so blatant. If you're unvaccinated, you're not eligible to receive universal basic income. And that's, in a way, what central bank digital currencies, one of the things that it could lead to, right?
Yeah, that's kind of a mixed emotion for me because I think the universal basic income is ridiculous. So, but then again, if you're that's what you've got and you can't get it, what do you do? I mean,
yeah, well, anyway, I just saw that in Brazil a couple days ago. It was like, okay, well, that's where we're headed with this stuff, maybe. I don't really want to get into trouble talking about this stuff. I'm probably in trouble already from some of my peers, but...
Well, sometimes we need to get in trouble, right?
Yeah, I know.
Well, it's been a pleasure interviewing you. Is there anything else you'd like to mention? We have like 5 more minutes that you'd really want to talk about so I don't get you in trouble. Keep asking questions that are controversial.
Well, so I would like to just put in a kind of a plug for the package of bills that Health Choice Vermont is working on in the legislature, and people can access those bills if they go onto the Health Choice Vermont website. Mm-hmm. It's laid out in a very simple form what the bill numbers are, who's sponsoring them, and what they're about. Also, the Vermont Daily Chronicle today has, for people who subscribe to that or go to it, has put up an article outlining these same bills. That they could please call their legislators in their area, and if they're in agreement with the bills, to ask them to support them.
Yeah, so, and if you do care about informed consent, one of the best things I think we can do locally is contact our representatives and get to know them and let them get to know you, because the more voices there are on a topic, the more they're likely to vote on that. So you just think the more of us that contact our representatives, the better chance we have at passing some of these bills that are just so logical.
Yes. So, yeah, I would encourage people to do that. It's not as scary as it seems. The legislators are just normal people like you and I, so there's no reason to feel intimidated at all by that.
No, and I think for the most part, they appreciate you contacting them. They want to hear from you. I know
they do.
Dara Torrey, one of our representatives here in the Mad River Valley, has a meeting once a week for the whole month. I think she meets at the Three Mountain Cafe on the last Saturday of the month at 10 a.m. So you can just go there, and she sits there and waits for people to come and talk to her.
Who is that?
Dara Torrey.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. She's doing it in Moortown 1 week, and I think one of the other two, maybe Warren 1 week, but I know in Waitsfield it's the last Saturday of the month at 10 a.m. in the Three Mountain Cafe, and she just goes there and she wants to talk to you. So if you care about these issues.
Legislators really appreciate hearing from constituents. And it's surprising because the legislators have a very hard job. They're in committees and they're faced with so many bills, so many decisions, and very often they're not very well informed about them. So it's important. They really want to hear from constituents who know something about the bills. So
yeah, that helps too. is to get educated about these bills and then go meet with them. And I know you're so much more schooled than I am, but I guess I just think even if you go to the State House, I did go to the State House the one day, and I wasn't quite sure what to do, so it may be just better to contact your local representatives and try and get a one-on-one meeting with them, or if they're having these town hall meetings, just go and see if you can talk to them there and let them know how you feel.
Yeah, you can, as a constituent, you can go to the State House and put in a pink slip to meet with your representative, and the page will track that person down, give them the slip, and they will look for you.
Yeah.
You know, you can set up a meeting, meet most of that kind of business takes place in the cafeteria at the State House. It's just kind of a big social hour. And but even if you don't have a specific plan, it can help to go in. You'll find Jennifer, myself, other people, like-minded people in there who can help and guide you and show you around. So don't be intimidated by that. It's pretty nice that we can just walk in there and talk to our legislators. They don't have staffers to get in the way. You can just talk to them.
Yeah, the advantages to a small state.
Oh, yeah.
Plus,
sure.
It's a beautiful building.
I have relatives that live in California. They don't have a prayer of doing something like we can do here.
Yeah, even Pennsylvania, you can't. It's not like Vermont. So, well, I want to really thank you for your time, Sandy. I've been speaking to Dr. Sandy Ryder, who has a medical practice in Lindenville for the last 30 years, has been practicing in Vermont since 1975, and is a graduate of Harvard Medical School. Thank you so much for taking the time.
All right. Well, thank you, Jerry. I appreciate it.
Yeah. And thanks, everybody, for listening. I'm going to turn you over to Hal, and then Gary Jackson will be in with Weekend Warm-Up at 2 o'clock. Have a great weekend.
All right. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Tower above the earth, there is a view that reaches far.